From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, November 4th, 2020.
This Day in Maine is made possible by New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org.
Two more people with COVID-19 in Maine have died, a woman in her 80s from Franklin County and a man in his 70s from Waldo County. Dr. Nirav Shah, the director of the state CDC, says the man's death is indirectly linked to the 60-case outbreak at the Brooks Pentecostal Church. Maine is in the midst of a surge of the coronavirus. Over the past 2 weeks, the total number of COVID-19 cases has grown by more than 1,000. Amid another record number of new COVID cases today, the Maine CDC has opened investigations into several more outbreaks. Dr. Shah says that in Augusta, 3 cases each have been identified at Advanced Health Physical Therapy and CrossFit Casco Bay Undaunted. And at the Hope Baptist Church in Manchester, there are 5 cases.
All 3 of the outbreak investigations just opened today are in Kennebec County, a concerning sign that infection rates as well as new outbreaks in that part of the state are on the rise.
Yesterday, the CDC opened an outbreak investigation at Calais Regional Hospital, where 6 staff members have tested positive. Democrat Jared Golden will once again represent Maine's 2nd District in Congress. Democrat Shelley Pingree will also return to Washington, as will Maine Senator Susan Collins. No races in Maine have had to go to ranked choice voting. In a statement this afternoon, the Secretary of State's office says candidates in all 4 of the races subject to RCV have won their races with more than 50% of the vote. And Republican Senator Susan Collins significantly outperformed her Democratic opponent in rural areas while still holding her own in cities, 2 trends that many political polls underestimated. Colby College government professor Dan Shea says in some towns, Collins garnered as many as 4 or 5 times as many votes as Democrat Sarah Gideon. He says he and other pollsters did not see that kind of performance reflected in their surveys.
Right. So there's one piece. I'm not sure we captured the preferences of rural Mainers as carefully as we might have.
Shea adds that he was also surprised to see a large percentage of voters split the ticket by supporting both a Republican senator and a Democratic presidential candidate. In weather tonight, partly to mostly cloudy with lows in the high 20s to the high 30s. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny with highs in the low 50s to the mid 60s. Friday, partly sunny with highs in the high 40s to the mid 60s. And on Saturday, mostly sunny skies with highs in the mid-50s up to the high 60s. This is Maine Public Radio. Republican Senator Susan Collins, as we've been hearing, has won a 5th term in office, fending off a strong challenge from Democratic State House Speaker Sarah Gideon in a race that attracted hundreds of millions of dollars in spending. Gideon conceded the race this afternoon. Robbie Feinberg has details.
The race for Collins' seat, which generated $200 million in spending, was the most expensive in Maine's history. The stakes were high, as the race was seen as a potential tipping point that could hand Democrats control of the Senate. Collins appeared to lag behind Gideon in the polls heading into Tuesday, but on election night she received far more votes in many rural areas and even defeated Gideon in traditional Democratic cities, such as Lewiston. And despite efforts by opponents to tie Collins to President Trump, she significantly outperformed the president statewide, securing about 51% of the vote as of Wednesday afternoon. Collins told reporters in Bangor that she was pleased to win in nearly every county.
But I've got to tell you, I was thrilled by the margin, and I was thrilled that communities all across the state supported my reelection.
The race drew national interest before Gideon even declared her intention to run, as several groups raised $4 million 2 years ago for Collins' eventual opponent, after she voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. She's also been hammered for approving a GOP tax bill in 2017, as well as voting not to impeach the president earlier this year. Gideon entered the race promising to focus on issues including health care and climate change, but her campaign and its nearly $69 million fundraising haul ultimately weren't enough. In a live-streamed video on Facebook on Wednesday, Gideon said that she was proud of her work and intended to continue to advocate for those issues.
Thousands of Mainers stood together. making phone calls, knocking on doors, talking to their friends and neighbors about what better leadership looks like. And that's what we need to continue to do. And I will continue to stand with you in that work.
Collins, meanwhile, noted that her win was historic, as it was the first time a Maine senator has been elected 5 times. And with Democrats still seeking to gain seats in the Senate, Collins could serve as a potential moderate vote in the chamber. She said that she'd already heard from Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia Wednesday morning about working together on a new coronavirus relief bill.
And I think that reflects what you've always seen. And it's the reason why year after year after year, for 7 years in a row, I've been ranked as the most bipartisan member of the Senate. That's the approach I've always taken. That's the approach I'm going to continue to take.
With Collins securing a majority of the vote, the race will not head to a ranked choice runoff. The two other candidates, Independents Max Lynn and Lisa Savage, both received less than 5% of the tally. In a statement, Savage described the money spent in the Senate race as a, quote, abomination, and says she hopes that ranked choice voting will pave the way for a less nasty style of politics moving forward. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And Maine Public Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler joins me now to talk about the race, what went wrong for Gideon, and why the polls got it so wrong.
First of all, the polls in this race, and there were a lot of them, failed to capture a few things. Above all, I don't think the surveys fully showed how voters were ambivalent about voting Collins out of office. That's not to say there weren't indications of that. There certainly were. But there was a lot of evidence in the polls that there would be split-ticket voters in the contest, which is to say there would be voters who picked Democratic Vice President Joe Biden, but who also voted to keep Collins in office. But the polls didn't capture how impactful those voters would be. Now, there could be a couple of reasons for that. I mean, maybe these folks were late-breaking, undecided voters, and there certainly were some of those. It's unclear, but what we do know is that Senator Collins outperformed President Donald Trump all over the state. And why was that a problem for Sarah Gideon? Well, because her entire campaign attempted to nationalize the race, to basically handcuff Collins to an unpopular president. But, you know, maybe that had an effect for some voters, but clearly not enough to get Gideon over the finish line.
I also noticed that Susan Collins won in Lewiston pretty early as the returns came in. And that seemed to foreshadow Gideon's problems in other cities and towns, yeah?
Let's look at Lewiston just for a minute. You're talking about one of the most populated cities in the state and one that leans pretty heavily Democrat. Joe Biden won Lewiston handily, and so did Democratic Congressman Jared Golden. But not Sarah Gideon. She lost it by 2 points. And I have to say that's pretty devastating if you're a Democratic candidate running statewide. If your campaign is basically trying to run up the margins in places like Lewiston and you can't do that, you're not going to win, especially when you're getting killed in the 2nd Congressional District, which was exactly what happened last night. But this weakness showed up all over the place in traditional Democratic strongholds. I mean, Gideon won towns like Scarborough, Old Orchard Beach, York, and Saco, but only by 5 or 7 point margins. Biden won those same places by 20 points and sometimes more. And what's interesting about that is Gideon's message was pretty in sync with Biden's. There really wasn't a lot of daylight there.
So what do you make of that? Why did Biden's message resonate there and not Gideon's?
Well, it's hard to know exactly why, but one could presume that some Maine voters just wanted to get rid of Trump, but they weren't ready to go with a fully Democratic Congress. That's usually how split-ticket voters operate. The other explanation is that Gideon just didn't give those voters enough of a reason to vote for her. I mean, her campaign was really trying to make this race a referendum on Trump and Collins. But that can only get you so far. You really need something to get people who are on the fence to basically be willing to knock off an incumbent, especially one who was as popular as Collins once was. And apparently Gideon just didn't do that.
Yeah, about Collins' popularity. Throughout this race, we were constantly being reminded that her popularity had basically fallen off a cliff. Did she suddenly become popular again?
No. I mean, all of the surveys, including the exit surveys, indicated that Collins was pretty unpopular and that a lot of voters thought she was too closely aligned with the president. but maybe some of those voters were convinced that Trump would lose, and therefore they were less worried, you know, about giving Collins a fifth term. You know, the other explanation is that Collins just ran a good campaign. Sure, she wouldn't say if she supported the president. Sure, she dodged questions about it. But what she did do is localize the race. She talked about what she's done over her career, what she's done this year. And you could quibble with whether those claims are everything they're cracked up to be, but clearly voters found them convincing.
And I know you are kind of short on sleep, but do you have any like lingering thoughts about this campaign, which generated so much spending? The last figure I saw was that it topped $200 million in Maine.
Yeah, that's crazy for a state with 1.3 million people. I think there's something instructive for candidates and others here. One of the reasons Sarah Gideon was a formidable candidate was precisely because she was so well-funded. I mean, she pulled in more than $116 million, and there's probably more that's out there that we haven't seen in recent reports. But that money really has its limits. I mean, you know, there are Democratic Senate candidates all over the country who suffered a similar fate yesterday, and all of them had more cash than they could possibly burn. And in Gideon's case, a lot of it, about 90%, came from out of state. Now, Collins had a similar ratio of out-of-state funding, but she also had a local pitch to Maine voters. Conversely, Gideon's money seemed more to come from people who saw Collins as sort of this avatar for Republicans' supine response to a very divisive and disruptive president who shatters norms on a daily basis. And she ran a campaign that seemed to channel those desires to punish Collins and Trump. But it just wasn't enough. I mean, you know, and for Collins, I think it'll be interesting to see how she operates over the next few years, especially if Joe Biden becomes the next president. Let's not forget that several left-leaning interest groups yanked endorsements of her and backed Gideon. Can those relationships be repaired? It's really hard to know. But if they can't, does that mean Collins will become more of a prototypical Republican? I mean, she says she'll work with anybody and will do whatever she can to reach across the aisle. But we really have to wait and see how this contest, which is very bitter and divisive, how it affects her going forward.
Well, many questions ahead. Steve, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure, Nora.
Polls that showed incumbent Democrat Jared Golden ahead of his Republican challenger Dale Crafts in the race for Maine's 2nd congressional district turned out to be accurate, but not by as wide a margin as predicted. As Susan Sharon reports, Golden will once again represent a mostly rural district that has been fickle when it comes to party favorites.
Golden, who squeaked out a victory 2 years ago and upset Republican incumbent Bruce Poliquin, is ahead with a solid 7% lead and 90% of precincts reporting. On Wednesday afternoon, Golden addressed reporters at Democratic headquarters in Lewiston shortly after Crafts called to congratulate him.
We both agreed we enjoyed getting to know each other better in the course of this campaign, and we plan to talk more in the months ahead about our families in the future, and some of his ideas to improve the lives of the people of Maine's 2nd District.
It was a stark contrast to the hard-fought political battle in 2018 that became the first congressional race to be decided by ranked choice voting, an outcome that was challenged unsuccessfully in federal court. Back then, the race reached a fever pitch with a record $24 million raised and spent on attack ads like this one.
Radical Golden will let government control your health care, ending Medicare as we know it, doubling taxes.
But this year, the latest campaign finance reports show just a fraction of that amount, with a little over $1 million for Crafts and about $5 million for Golden. And the race was mostly low-key, both on the airwaves and off. This television ad featuring Isabel Golden highlighted her husband's biographical narrative, his roots in the 2nd District, military service, and record of straddling the party line.
I saw my husband on TV a lot when he ran for Congress 2 years ago. But the way Washington Republicans tried to scare Mainers about him just made me laugh. So before they try it again, the real Jared Golden grew up in rural Maine. served as a Marine in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now he's one of the most independent members of Congress.
Golden has made expansion of health care and lower prescription drug prices a priority for his campaign, along with protections for veterans and seniors. But in the conservative 2nd District, where President Donald Trump remains popular, Golden has tried to walk a tightrope. This is what he told Maine Public in 2018.
I'm not looking to be defined someone that is, you know, there in opposition, but rather someone that's there serious about doing the job and doing the work.
In his first campaign, Golden followed through with a pledge to vote against House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And later, he became the only House member to break from his party and vote against one of two impeachment articles against the president. Republican Dale Crafts, meanwhile, earned President Trump's endorsement and turned it into an extended commercial on social media.
Dale Crafts is somebody that is just so respected by everybody. Everybody loves him. They respect him and they love him. We need Dale Crafts in Congress fighting for our police and our safety, our jobs, our borders, our Second Amendment, and our God-given rights in every way.
A businessman and former state legislator from Lisbon, Crafts campaigned on the themes of reducing regulations, repealing the Affordable Care Act, and privatizing Social Security. He made his Christian faith and support of gun rights a big part of his message, and he tried to portray Golden as out of step with constituents. But by late Tuesday night, even he was forced to admit that he was the one who was not keeping up.
The numbers are not favorable to me for this race, but we fought a good fight, and we're going to see what things look like in the morning, and then we'll take it from there.
In a written statement Wednesday, Kraft said he told Golden he'd be praying for him and for the nation's future. My biggest hope is that we can all come together at the end of this election season and remember that we are all Americans, Kraft said. For his part, Golden says he's proud of running a positive campaign focused on his record, something political pundits advised him couldn't be done if he wanted to win the race.
We show that voters are hungry for a positive tone, positive leadership, and civility in our public space. I heard that message everywhere I've been over this big district.
The same big district where Donald Trump, with a decidedly different message, just captured one electoral vote. Golden acknowledged that the forces trying to divide the nation are stronger than ever, and so he says are the challenges of combating the coronavirus, keeping people safe, and addressing economic inequality.
There's so much more work that needs to be done in this country, but the only way we can get there is by seeking common ground and focusing on results.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Democrats have maintained control of the state legislature, increasing their numbers in the state Senate by a single seat to 22, while losing some seats in the House, but still maintaining control. Matt Leary joins me now from our State House Bureau to explain what control of the legislature actually means. Mal, at the top of the ticket, we have races like president and the Senate. Those have dominated this election season. But control of the state legislature is also a big deal. Were there any surprises this year?
Nora, there are always surprises every election year. I would say the biggest one this year was Senate Republican leader Dana Dow being defeated by a freshman state representative, Chloe Maxman. But there were also at least a half dozen House seats that shifted to the Republicans. And that could reach a total of 11 based on expected recounts that have yet to be actually asked for and scheduled. But even with those gains, the Democrats still maintain control of the House of Representatives.
So what does that actually mean? What does having control of the legislature really mean?
I think the most important part is that it means setting the agenda for when legislation is considered, and it means control of the legislative council. Well, the council oversees operations of the legislature. It's made up of the president of the Senate, the speaker of the House, and the 8 elected floor leaders from the 2-party caucuses. The council sets policies. They oversee the nonpartisan professional staff, and they control, most importantly, bills that are allowed in for consideration after any filing deadlines.
Governor Janet Mills must be pleased if she again has Democrats in control of both chambers of the legislature. Does that help with her getting her agenda through?
I'm sure the governor is probably quite pleased that the Democrats maintain majorities, but she's still going to need Republican support to pass any emergency legislation. and the pandemic will likely lead to legislation that does need that two-thirds vote to pass. And sometimes, on some issues, Mills will face opposition in her own party. Party members that want to move forward on some issues that can get very expensive, and it looks like there's not going to be much money around for any new initiatives. With the economic impact of the pandemic still very real, the likelihood is that any budget that gets passed will end up cutting some spending, not increasing it.
Now, remind me also, we've been seeing a lot of Matt Dunlap around lately, the Maine Secretary of State, but we won't be for long because he is termed out. Remind me of Maine's unique way that that we choose some like important positions like Secretary of State.
When the new legislature is sworn in the first week in December, they actually elect three positions that are created in the state constitution. The Secretary of State, Matt Dunlap, the Attorney General, and the State Treasurer. Dunlap's term limited as Secretary of State, and there are at least a half dozen candidates already that have been running for that vacancy. So far, no one has surfaced to challenge the Attorney General, Aaron Fry, or State Treasurer Henry Beck. But that may happen after all the recounts are completed, and it's clear that who will be casting votes at the Joint Convention to elect these officers. The Joint Convention is both the House and Senate meeting, so it takes 93 votes if everyone's present in order to elect those officers. It may well be lawmakers spend as much time politicking this month as they did in their own elections.
Well, Mel Leary with our State House Bureau. Thanks a lot, Mel.
Thank you, Nora.
Portland voters yesterday decisively put the city at the forefront of progressive urban politics, raising the local minimum wage to one of the highest in the nation, imposing rent control, and lifting a cap on recreational marijuana shops. And as Fred Bever reports, some of the city's employers and housing developers are a little rattled. They say the changes will force them to look elsewhere for business opportunities.
Four of the five ballot items Portland voters approved were proposed by a group called People First Portland, an outgrowth of the Southern Maine Democratic Socialists of America.
We are People First Portland!
Yeah. Member Kate Sykes led a celebratory press conference on the steps of City Hall.
People First Portland has achieved historic victory yesterday in passing a higher minimum wage for all workers and hazard pay for essential workers, a ban on racist facial surveillance, a Green New Deal to reduce our carbon footprint, and renter protections to prevent price gouging.
The measures cannot be changed for 5 years from enactment unless by a new citywide vote. That inflexibility was one of their chief reasons. Seven of Portland's nine city councilors opposed them. Many in the business community opposed them as well, including the affordable housing community. Dana Topman is president of Avesta Housing, which develops and manages hundreds of affordable units in Portland and elsewhere in the region. He says various provisions of the measures would add costs for developers of both affordable and market-rate housing and likely drive them to seek more opportunities in other communities, such as Westbrook or South Portland.
So I think this will really curtail housing development in Portland. It will really hurt the supply. I think a number of the projects that were in the pipeline, in the works, are perhaps not going to go forward.
Activist Kate Sykes responds that the development community has already failed Portland.
It doesn't get much slower than what it already is. So, yeah, they need to figure that out. And if you look at the ordinance itself, it actually increases the amount of affordable housing that must be built when market housing is built.
That was a reference to a provision raising the number of affordable units developers must include in certain city projects from 10% to 25%. Several developers say they simply could not profitably meet that standard and will look elsewhere for opportunity. Meanwhile, city employers are trying to figure out how to survive both the pandemic and the new minimum wage rule. Although a hike from $12 an hour now to $15 an hour will be phased in over 3 years, its effect will be amplified next month. That's because the measure requires that those who physically work in the city when a civil emergency has been declared must be paid at least 1.5 times the minimum wage. As long as the governor's emergency orders are in place, that will effectively make the city's minimum wage $18 an hour starting next month.
But I don't know how to pay for it.
Lori Moses is executive director of the Catherine Morrill Daycare Center, where she oversees a staff of 19.
If we reduce capacity, that means, if you know, to me as a child care director, that means, do I close the classroom? And if I close the classroom, which group of children are no longer going to have child care? So the ripple effects means that those parents can't work.
But Em Burnett, another organizer with People First Portland, says the city and state must come to a new reckoning to meet the needs of workers as well as employers during the pandemic.
We know that when workers are paid more, they spend more money in the local economy. We think that it's time to center the needs of workers who are risking their lives to work in the middle of a pandemic. And businesses do, again, they have grants available, they have resources available to help them, but workers do not have the same resources. We need to center them.
And the organizers, who include former Portland Mayor Ethan Strimling, blamed city officials for failing to address rising inequities before exasperated voters took matters into their own hands. They also say that with the election of two new city councilors who support their issues, they believe a more productive era was launched in the city this week. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. I'm Nora Flaherty.